Welcome to Real Vision. It's Tuesday, October 20, 2020, just after market close in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington, joined shortly by Hedge Fund Telemetry's Tom Thornton. But first, with the day's stories, Haley Drasnan.
Hey, Ash. Well, we saw markets rise on Tuesday after a rough Monday. The Dow, NASDAQ, and S&P 500 all rebounded from yesterday's sell-off as lawmakers continue efforts to reach a spending bill. A package must be agreed to today in order for it to pass before the November 3rd election. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says differences with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin are narrowing in stimulus negotiations. However, that does not mean that a bill will be able to pass in the Senate, as Senate Republicans are still resisting the price tag on it. President Trump and the White House have increased their package proposal to $1.8 trillion. Senate Republicans still think this is a bit too high, whereas Democrats would like to see it around $2 to $2.2 trillion. Investors can expect more volatility given an increase in COVID cases that we're seeing play out here in the United States as well as in Europe. The economy needs some support and the markets need some form of guidance. In recent weeks, we're seeing the markets have swung a lot in every twist of these talks. If the stimulus negotiations do pass, I think we'll continue to see stocks rally. But if the negotiations do fall apart and we can't get it passed before the election, I imagine that it'll be likely there will be, you know, a short-lived sell-off in stocks as well. Another interesting story that I wanted to cover today is the U.S. Department of Justice antitrust lawsuit of Google, allegedly accusing them of abusing their power, specifically for the tech giant's dominance in online search. Shares of Alphabet, Google's parent company, actually edged higher, though, on Tuesday following news of this lawsuit. This is all on top of a handful of corporate earnings that were announced this week. Procter & Gamble, we saw their shares rise, maybe even being the best organic sales growth since 2005. This rise was in fiscal first quarter earnings and boosting its guidance. Lockheed Martin, on the other hand, we saw some of their shares fall after the aerospace and defense contractor reported third quarter revenue that beat estimates and raised its full year outlook. And we're keeping an eye on how Netflix performs when it releases its earnings today after the markets close. Now turning to UBS, the world's largest wealth manager, reported its best third quarter for a decade. Net income came in at $2.1 billion. That's a 99% jump from the same period a year earlier. This is surprising as its profit for the second quarter saw a 11% drop. You know, this is the first of the results for the European banks. Last week, we saw a number of U.S. banks perform greater than expected. Global coronavirus cases are now exceeding 40 million and showing no signs of it slowing down. Several European countries are imposing new restrictions, especially on business activity and travel. Another story that I wanted to share with you all today was Fed Chairman Jerome Powell. He's taking a cautious approach to possibly issuing digital currency. Yesterday on an IMF panel, he pointed to potential benefits, including faster and less costly international transactions. But the Fed must also consider the risk of cybersecurity, counterfeiting, and fraud, as well as the impact on monetary and fiscal policy. You know, this comes as more central banks are really stepping up their research on the costs and benefits of central bank digital currencies, which would act as a supplement to existing national currency. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell yesterday had said, and I quote, "It's more important to get it right than to be first. This is because of the dollar's central role in global financial transactions." And I want to point out, you know, Rao's expert view on all of this yesterday, where he talks about the recent tidal wave of interest in central bank digital currencies. And Rao says he sees that central bank digital currencies are really the killer of stablecoins and the start of a new era in the world of monetary and fiscal policy. You know, this is the first major step at technology eating away at the traditional financial world. And on that note, back to you, Ash.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing Board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Tom, welcome back to the show. Always a pleasure to have you here.
Nice to be back.
So, Tom, what are you looking at today?
Here we are. We have we're hitting the peak of earnings this week into next week, and I think that this is going to be a market that is going to look really close at third quarter earnings. And I've been thinking, economic reports that we've had have started to plateau starting in September, and will earnings start to plateau as well? I'm looking right now at Netflix. It's down 5 or 6%. After hours didn't look like a very good report. Texas Instruments is up a little bit. They usually are a very good tell for the semis.
So let's talk a little bit about earnings then. Tell us what your view of 3Q is. What have we heard so far, and whether you think we're at par or you see a differential?
Well, so far, I think the earnings beats have been a little stronger. And the problem, though, is the stocks aren't getting rewarded for those beats. And that's been a problem that I've seen a few other times. I think it was like the first quarter after the stimulus. The big tax cut was announced. The stocks were blowing away earnings, but the stocks didn't respond favorably. So that's sometimes a sign that things are getting priced in. And we had a huge third quarter for the market. We've had a huge move from March. So I think, you know, it's important to watch where things are. If we start to see a topping pattern, usually Q4 sees a rebound, but we could see a pullback first, and then we'll go from there. We do have the election, and I'm not getting into politics, but that always could be a little bit of a catalyst there too.
You can't go wrong by avoiding politics in 2020.
I'm not talking politics today.
So, but let's talk about something that is, a first cousin of politics, which is what's happening with the stimulus. What are your thoughts there? And what's the impact in terms of U.S. equity markets and other risk assets?
Well, we're unfortunately addicted to stimulus, Fed intervention, fiscal stimulus. I wrote the other day that on the anniversary of the 87 crash, and actually it was the 20th of October, that Greenspan came out with one line basically in support of the Fed ensuring liquidity for all the financial institutions. And I think right then that did it. That was where the market said, okay, the Fed has our back. And I don't think the market has ever let that down. I think Greenspan saw the benefit of him coming in and injecting liquidity, or saying that they're going to inject liquidity. And I think the market has just become completely addicted to stimulus. We can't live without it. And now it's like a kabuki theater of, are we going to get a stimulus package? Is it going to be, you know, 1.8 trillion? Is it going to be 2 trillion? It doesn't matter. It just gets bigger and bigger, and we're bailing out more people. And I think there's going to come a point, don't know when, but it's going to end, and it's not going to end well. And the growth in the economy is going to slow because of all this debt. And all these people that look at MMT, I think it's just a very lazy way of bailing people out. And I think it's a moral hazard, which people don't talk about enough.
So the question is, obviously, this is a long-term 30-year secular trend, there's a debt bomb that's coming. But if you've been short these markets, even since the beginning of COVID, you've gotten whacked. How do you play these markets in this time?
Right. I'm not sure at the markets. Obviously, that would be just a complete disaster. And I'm not playing for the debt bomb to explode. I think it's going to happen in small explosions, and then we'll start to see things unwind. And I don't know when that will happen. But as far as how I'm looking at the markets, I will play the ebbs and flows and take advantage of the 10% pullbacks, the 10% lifts, sector rotation, which I think is going to be a real theme for 2021. So I don't know when everything's going to come to a massive end with that. I don't really want that either, honestly, because I think it's going to be rather painful. We'll probably see things happen outside of the U.S. that will start to affect the U.S. I don't think the U.S. is going to be the debt jubilee, initiate their own debt jubilee. I think you're going to see some other smaller countries initiate those debt jubilees first. But you know, right now I'm trying to just stay even, go with the ebbs and flows in the market. And I think that's really the most important thing everybody can do.
Yeah. Tom, maybe we could zoom the camera out a little bit and you can give us a better sense of your framework and how you think about time horizons. I think one of the most critical challenges that people who are new to the investment space have is understanding that you can be, you know, you can be long-term short and short-term long, and all of these sort of imbalances that come from not understanding how people think about trade horizons. The decades of experience that you've had investing and trading these markets, what are your thoughts? How do you think about time horizons?
Well, I look at a lot of time horizons, and I recommend people looking at in the shorter term. I look at on my charts every day in front of me are 15-minute charts, and those are I use for intraday trading, entry into positions. I look at daily, I look at intermediate weekly time frames, and I don't necessarily look at a lot of monthly charts because I think there's a lot of wiggle room in there. But I will also take a framework of saying, okay, we have a long-term weekly chart that is moving in this direction. I will play it with a daily, and the dailies obviously will move in advance. I risk manage around the daily charts. So for example, if I'm long a position, I get a nice gain, I'll take some off and then add some back on dips if I like that position. But I think it's really important that when you see a really persistent trend, let's say the FANGs, I tracked the FANG stocks all summer. They were just completely moving in the right direction up, and everybody was just, this is the greatest thing. But I ran a trend line on those. And as soon as those trend lines broke, then these became a liability in people's portfolios. And you could see it on the daily, and then you can also see it on the weekly. And I like to see when, if you have a real reversal, you see a four-week low on a weekly chart. If that happens, I think that then you could really be seeing a longer-term or intermediate-term pullback. So my time horizon varies, but I would say that it is between 2 and 5 weeks. Those are the time horizons that I'm looking for. I think that gives enough time for a trade to develop or a trade not to work, and you can exit out of it. So that's really how I tend to look at things. I'll trade around things. I'll be in and out of things. But for the most part, I try to stay in things longer than I try to stay in things as long as possible.
Yeah. And what are the trend lines that you look at?
Well, this has been a very easy year for trend lines because you look at the bottom in March and you just run them up into August, and anything that's broken those trend lines. I think right now, a really big pattern that I'm looking at is a lower high developing right now with the markets. And that is an Elliott wave. The first move down in September was the first wave. Then we have a lower wave. Wave two corrective wave, which doesn't make a higher high over the August highs. And then if we break those levels, that would be into the third wave down. And if you go back to 1987, we also had a lower high and it failed, and then it broke those the previous lows on the first wave down, and then it really became unglued. I'm not saying we're going to see another type of situation like that. I'm not predicting a 1987, but I certainly think that there could be a risk off moment if we do break those September lows. So I think anybody that's watching their charts, it's very simple. Keep it simple. Look at the September lows. If we break those, I think we're going to have real risk in the market.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very straightforward answer. What do you think in terms of the probability of seeing that occur are right now, or is it just impossible to determine based on where we are in the pattern?
Well, we've been dropping for several days from last week, and I'm looking at the five-day rolling returns, and they're starting to turn negative. The one-month rolling returns, which I look at as well, and a bunch of different factors and markets, those are still positive because we bottomed, I think, on the 24th of September. So as we start to roll into a little higher next week, those returns are going to start to soften a bit. And when people see their returns are not as good after a month, and let's say we do break those September lows, I think people become very motivated to sell. They don't like holding things that they're down in. And if they're holding things, I mean, people always sell lower. I always tell people it's people don't sell high. They sell lower. They panic. They sell. And the panic always brings in larger volume on the downside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And with that, I should say today's market's fractionally higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, S&P 500, NASDAQ, and Russell 2000 all up between 0.25% and 0.47%. The leader on this was the S&P 500, closing up 0.47% at 34.43.
It's also interesting that we're seeing a little bit of a rotation back to some value as well. This pullback in the market, we've seen financials and energy pick up a bit, and the regional banks actually had a really good day. I'm long the regional banks. I'm long XLF. I like several, you know, a handful of the large financials. I think they have opportunity on the long side. It's not easy. I think that the seeing interest rates go up is giving people a little bit of confidence that that will help the financials here. Energy stocks, I'm starting to see a lot of mergers occur. We saw, I think, Concho was bought out. We have, what is the other one? PD. Okay, everybody's saying, I know that one. But we're seeing some small ones get bought. And we're also, I study insider buying, and I'm seeing insider buying and a bunch of different financials out there. So I think there's going to be a big consolidation wave in financials just to survive. And I also think if Biden gets in, I think it will be a positive for the financials, financials and especially energy. And I a lot of people will say, well, why would you think that? But I think he's going to put restrictions on drilling, and less drilling, higher prices. And I think that will help the energy sector. I mean, everybody thought that with Trump, I'm getting getting into politics, Ash, don't get mad. But everybody thought, with Trump coming in, it's going to be great for all the industrials and the energy companies. It's his best friends. But it's been absolutely terrible because they've drilled more. There's a ton of supply out there. So if we can limit supply, keep demand relatively stable, I think the energy stocks could benefit from that, which I think is a contrary trade, and they've been awful. So it's, all bets are off if these things, break some new lows.
Yeah, it's an interesting thesis. Energy Select Spider, XLE up today, 1.18%. Whatever that is, three or four times more than the indices on the equity side.
Yeah, it's a big little value rotation today, and maybe it's the mergers that are happening. I think Halliburton's earnings were okay. Schlumberger the other day was okay, not great, but those stocks rebounded after falling a little bit. So I don't know. I kind of like these. I kind of see the value in these. And again, if the supply is constrained and fracking is curtailed in a little bit, I think these things can work.
Yeah. Once again, slightly bigger picture question to leverage some of your decades of market experience. How do you think about sectors and what are the ETFs or other mechanisms that you look at as proxies for those sectors and that rotation that we've just talked about?
Well, I look at all the main, I look at things top down. So I look at all the major sector ETFs. I have a list of 165 ETFs that I look at. So I look at, where things are moving. And one of the things that I like to look at from a technical point of view is I rank all these ETFs by percentage above or below the 50-day moving average. And it's a monitor that I created when I worked at my hedge fund for one of the partners, because he said, look, I need you to force rank your favorite ideas. So I said, okay, I'm going to make something up mechanically that works. And so you could see things work in that range. So for example, remember everybody loved gold stocks in the summer and every, GDX and GLD and silver were just ripping. These things got so far over the 50-day moving average, and I can chart that and say, oh my God, it gets too overdone. But now those are down. I think the SLV is now down 4% below the 50-day moving average. It was, I think, 28% above the 50-day moving average. So I see these rotations happen. So I look at a lot of different sectors, and energy has been absolutely on the bottom for, I think, at least 9 months. And now they're starting to pick up. The XOP is above the 10-day moving average. You're starting to see that those start to move. You see those move over the 10-day moving average and then the 20-day moving average. XOP is above the 20-day moving average as well. It's still 9% below the 50-day moving average. So I think there's a mean reversion there. Mm-hmm. But that's a start. That's what I like to see. I'm also looking at like XLY, which the consumer discretionary, just ticked under the 10-day moving average. It's only above the 50-day by 3%, with the average of all the sectors I look at being around 3.5% above the 50-day moving average. So I see rotations when I look at ETFs, and then I can also, within those ETFs or sectors, I can see what stocks are leading in the same framework with percentage above the 50-day moving average. So it's top down all the way. And that's how I look at the sector rotation with ETFs. And right now, we'll see if this can last. Remember one thing also, seasonality for energy stocks is awful in Q4. So I'm a little skeptical that these will last, but we'll see. With an election, there could be some new policies. It could be some, shakeouts, but I'm kind of sticking with these for right now.
Yeah. So you're just looking at a 50-day simple moving average on these.
Yeah. But I want to see them. I want to see the sector ETFs move above the 10 and 20 day or move below. I mean, I short them as well. So, but right now I'm fairly long the market. I've taken some profits on some of the recent longs over the last couple of weeks. But I think that, it's kind of a hold your nose and stay long in the market right now.
Yeah. One of the things I'm curious to ask you about, Tom, is the way that you think of that long-short balance. I mean, I said earlier when we were off camera that you're a man with more nerve than I have to go short these markets when you're fighting the tape and fighting the Fed and fighting fiscal stimulus. How do you think about that? And how do you think about those risks? How much higher of a conviction do you need to go short in markets when you're potentially, as I said, fighting those very powerful forces?
Well, it's not easy to short stocks or indices in a market that's, supported by the Fed and the market that perceives that there's stimulus coming or sees that there's huge liquidity injections all over the world with central banks. It's not easy. But I look at a lot of different technical things. I look at DeMarc indicators that expect exhaustion signals on the upside. I'll shoot against those. And if I'm wrong, I'll stop out and move on. And a lot of times you can get an exhaustion signal right now on Netflix a week ago, and now it's down 6%. And it's a fine craft that I learned when I worked at my hedge fund with some of the best short sellers. And if you think I have nerve, they've taught me a lot about shorting, and they had unbelievable nerves to just drinking their coffee after hours and selling 500,000 Qs. Like nothing, you know, sell 500 Qs, you know, no problem. After hours. Get a market from Goldman. Yeah, okay. 5 cents. Okay, no problem. That's what we did.
That is quite the high wire act, isn't it?
It took nerves. It was a good time.
So you mentioned DeMarc indicators. For people who are relatively new to technical analysis, why are DeMarc indicators, and I know you've talked about them before, at least in passing, why are DeMarc indicators such a powerful tool for you in terms of the way that you see markets?
Well, Tom DeMarc created these indicators that he has about probably 100 different indicators, 70 that are available, that calculate periods of exhaustion in the markets or in individual security, commodities, currencies. And it really works to my personality that I like to look for peaks and bottoms. And I've been able to use the indicators. When you get a DeMarc 13 exhaustion signal, which he developed also by hand on paper in the 70s, and then computers came around and he looked at it and said, actually, this works. You can really use those indicators and say, okay, I'm going to buy this particular stock or whatever at this price and use a stop below it if I'm wrong. And they really do work fairly well. When they don't work, I hear about it. When they do work, usually it's pretty quiet. Nobody just really matters. But if you don't have the indicators, it's really difficult to understand how they work. There's a lot of ifs, ands involved here. But I've used them for over 20 years. I feel really confident integrating those into my process with other technical indicators that I use. I also look at market sentiment. So when they work well. And when they don't work, you also know, and that's a real good tell to, you know, move on. Again, I used, like, the FANG stocks were going up all summer. I had several DeMarc indicators that pulled back 3%, or the market pulled back 3%, and that was it. People said they didn't work. They actually did. They were telling you that it was a really strong trend. I mean, it was, you know, and then, you know, sometimes the market will get to this, you know, place and it'll hovercraft and just sort of, you know, levitate here. And I think that also is a big tell. So it like one thing I'm looking at right now, copper went up. Levitated, went sideways with exhaust signals. It was just basically tired, and now it's starting to make another move. So the DeMarc indicators are telling me that it's possible to make another move higher with copper. So it's things like that. So I have actually tried to explain on my notes how they work in real time, and it takes quite a while to understand them and see when they're right and when they're wrong. So that's basically what I've done with them. But I like them because you can kind of shoot against a top or a bottom. And if you don't have the indicators on your screen, you think that they're just like, you know, what are they looking at? But they tend to work pretty well.
Yeah. I know that Rao follows DeMarc indicators on several different dimensions, and I think it's interesting to have that conversation.
Yeah, we actually so Bitcoin today has an upside exhaustion 13 today. And I know everybody's very interested in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I don't trade Bitcoin, but I follow it pretty closely for our subscribers. And the DeMarc signals have actually been really, really good with Bitcoin. And they one day after the peak, I think it was in 2017, I said, I don't know anything about Bitcoin, but I got this DeMarc signal happening here. And basically it went down to, I think, 3,000. And at 3,000, we actually got signals as a buy. And recently in the 10,000 level, we had 11,000, we got another sell signal. I was speaking with Raul on Twitter on it, and we went back down to 10,000. And now we have another upside sell signal. I'm more neutral on it because I think that there's a longer term, as you said, daily and weekly, I think there's a longer term upside exhaustion signal out there. So if we get a pullback, I think it's viable. I like seeing what Michael Saylor and Jack Dorsey are doing with Bitcoin. I think it's going to be adopted further.
Right.
I'd just like to buy it a lot lower.
Yeah. The corporate treasury function aspect of Bitcoin is a fascinating one. On the flip side of the coin, on more of the tactical side, it does seem that 12,000 may be something of a key level.
Yeah, it could be. It could be the level that we sort of stall out. I can also make a case on the weekly chart for 16,658 exactly. I'm looking at my chart right now. So that's an upside signal or DeMarc wave price objective that I can make out. The upside signal on the daily, just to kind of let people know, from that upside signal, the last one was 12,019. So that was the exact number that we were looking for, and that was a level that we were looking for from back. That was calculated back in April. So when Bitcoin was in the 6,000 level, we had a $12,000 target on it, and it worked.
Quite a correlation.
Yeah.
So yeah. Tom, lots happening right now in markets, lots of news flow, lots of noise. Final thoughts on where you think we are right now?
Well, we have 2 weeks ahead of election. We have the bulk of Q3 earnings happening right now. I think being very nimble is the appropriate strategy. We have a stimulus that's going back and forth. And I think you want to stay net long at this point until something changes. And if something changes, take down more risk. But it's not a market that you want to be levered. It's not a market that you need to be fully invested. It's a market that you can be late getting long if we have a favorable outcome after the election, or if the market sees it as a favorable outcome. So I think it's just a matter of right now being very cautious, not necessarily taking huge amounts of risk. You don't need the floor to fall out beneath you. And that's certainly the type of market that we're in. It's an October surprise market. You've got two candidates that are fighting for it, and who knows what's going to happen with this election. But take it easy. Don't get too far over your skis.
Yeah. I just hope we know sometime in November.
Yeah, that'd be nice. I mean, hopefully. Hopefully.
Tom Thornton, thanks once again for joining us.
All right. See you later.